The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 12th of March, 2021. On the podcast today, George Franceschides, Executive Chairman of Alba Mineral Resources, provides an update on their Clogau St. David's gold mine. Also, Paul Hill, full-time investor, equity analyst, give his view on the markets, what stocks he's been buying. And we also talk about Avacta, Taylor Wimpey, Source Bio, Northbridge, Verici DX, and GSK. Also, Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the biggest winners and losers since the dash for cash in March 2020. We also discussed some of the winners and losers since Pfizer Day, when they announced the first vaccine was announced. Plus, as always on the podcast, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most read RNSs too. By the way, you can see both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. We see lots of other content. In fact, there's an article there on T Power, listed today, and it's about battery tech, so obviously very popular. There's also one on Kistos there, an article on Camembert, there's one on Alba, and if you go there as well, I always like checking out our COVID-19 index. Biggest riser there today is Hemogenix Pharmaceuticals, up 10%, 6.8. Also, Gfinity, big bounce today, second biggest riser, 5, because it was a big seller yesterday. Cleared the market, the seller cleared, and it's back on the normal track. Hopefully, that's where the pressure came from. Our biggest fall of the day is Tech Capital, down 4.76% to 15 pence. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is George Franceschides, Executive Chairman of Alba Mineral Resources, ALBA is ticker there. George, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin, for having me.
Yeah, and for briefly, this is audio, of course, but sometimes we get to see a glimpse of you on video, and I saw there you have a nice T-shirt on, and it's talking about the gold of Wales. And so what is it? Where did you get those from, George?
We got a bit of merchandising recently come through, Justin. So yeah, we've got some nice Gold Mines of Wales polo shirts. It was an attempt to tell my team that the spring is coming, yeah. That they can wear instead of wearing fleeces, that we might be able to crack out the short sleeves. So I don't think we're quite there yet, but I've got mine on anyway.
Yeah, it's getting closer to it. The release of the lockdown, plus the weather's getting better, and of course that's appropriate, those polo shirts, because you are talking about Clogau St. David's gold mine in this update. But before we get into that, George, it's not just about that, Alba. You've got other things going on. So just give us a brief summary of the overall business, if you could.
Yeah, absolutely. We're quite a diverse portfolio of mining assets we've got at Alba. We are a mining company first and foremost, and we've got some assets that we're pushing into the development phase in Wales, which we'll talk about. We've got a suite of gold projects and gold mines actually there, which is pretty unique. And in Greenland, we've got some very, very high value, really big potential projects there as well, which we don't talk about a lot at the moment because we're doing so much at Wales, but we will come back to those, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. Well, down there, in the team down there in Wales, St. David's Gold Mine, you're going through phase one of surface drilling, all that. So what's been happening? Tell us some of the results and what's next as well. But start of what you found so far, if you could.
Sure. Well, we've just finished our phase one surface drilling programme, Justin. So the last hole was number 10, and I think we've saved the best till last, really. So what we're trying to do there is to hit quartz veins at about 100 metres below the previously deepest workings at Lechfraith, which is a mine area within the Clogau St. David's Gold system. And not only did we hit it at 100 metres, we hit the gold, the quartz veining at 122 metres. So it was way exceeded our expectations, and it still remains open at depth. So there is every prospect for making hitting quartz veining even deeper than that. But we're happy with our lot, and that's the end of phase one. So, as I say, number 10 is probably the best hole of the lot, about 8 and a bit meters of quartz veining that we've intersected, including one intercept of about 3.7 meters. So that's by far the widest of any of the ones that we've come across in this phase of drilling. So what that's telling us is now that we've got confidence that there is a big unit there. There's a load system, effectively loads, just so people understand, you know, in common day parlance, just another word for quartz, really, quartz veins. So it's a quartz vein system, but we call it a load. So we've modelled that now, and we're estimating, it's high-level estimation, about 24,000 to 27,000 tonnes in that load, which has never been mined before. So whilst we don't yet know grade, because the core needs to get sent off to the lab to be assayed, what we do know is that we've got a very big unit there that's replete with quartz veins. That is where all the gold has previously been produced from at Clogai. And, you know, it's going to be a big focus for future development, bulk mining, and see what's down there. There's a lot of material there. So, you know, it's, you know, really, really good result, I would say, from the first one, phase one drilling.
Yeah, I was going to say, so phase one at the moment, would you say it's exceeded your expectations, or is it on par? What would you say?
Well, I think the good thing is that our team feel very satisfied with their model, their 3D model that they've developed, because we're pretty much hitting the quartz veins exactly where, I would say exactly, not within the millimeter, but within, you know, tens of centimeters, kind of where we expect to hit it on every hole now. So it is really following the model. Of course, we develop that model as we go along. But yeah, no, it's the fact that we've got 122 metres depth and about 52 metres of strike extent, so width, if you like, and anything, you know, the thickness of the quartz veins varies, but we haven't done any average calculations. But I think the calculations we've done have shown that this is a really big unit. So I'd say definitely exceeded our expectations so far.
Okay, and then obviously I assume there's a phase two next, but what happens in between that, between phase one and phase two?
Yeah, well, we hope to move straight into phase two, to be honest, Justin. Okay. And we're just waiting on for one permit to drop, and then we'll be straight into phase two surface drilling. Now, the big news really from this drill program that we've just finished isn't only that we've got this big quartz load vein system underneath Letfraith mine area. It's also that what it's telling us is that our hypothesis that, you know, that there's a lot of quartz vein and a lot of gold bearing structure left behind that was never tapped in previous periods of mining is, you know, very much still alive, that hypothesis, right? Because we've now proven that hypothesis at Letfraith by finding a very big quartz vein system that's never been touched before. So the good thing is we're going to be able to test that hypothesis even further very shortly, because we're going to be drilling in phase two from surface again down into the depths, if you like, of some of the other previously worked zones, places called Grandfather's Lode and 710 Lode. We're going to be drilling beneath those previously mined areas to see again, does the structure continue at depth? You know, we've got every prospect of finding that they do, because it would be very strange if they didn't. But, you know, it's really good that we've been hitting quartz veins on pretty much every hole. Otherwise, it would have been a pretty damp squib this last program, but it's been anything but that. So phase two, going to get into it very quickly, we hope, and drill underneath those other two previously worked areas, and also this 550-metre projected extension to the main load, which we've identified in our underground drilling last year. So there's a lot of big targets, big juicy targets there that we're going to be drilling, and we hope to get obviously a similar, if not as good, if not better results than we've just had.
Yeah. What's, I mean, but nice to get your thoughts on gold, because I can't understand the price action of gold. It's coming off a bit, and I said just before we came on, it's a bit like copper. But when copper was low and everyone thought, well, hang on, copper is a really hot, you know, go back three, maybe 12 months probably, when copper wasn't rallying, and people thought, well, copper is one of the hot commodities, especially in the EV space. Now, you've got money printing going on left, right and centre on the world, and so hard assets are where it's at, but yet gold is coming off. Do you think we're at one of those spots where, you know, looking back, we'll think, God, that was such an opportunity to dive into gold then?
Yeah, no, I mean, quite possibly. I mean, look, I hesitate to preface all of my comments about gold with do your own research, as all the investors like to say on the chat rooms. But I am by no means an expert, but you know, there are certainly plenty of gold bugs out there who are still very bullish and view this as a correction. Now, of course, they would say that, wouldn't they? But there are lots of indications that this may well just be a correction in the upward trajectory of gold. But you know, however that may be, I mean, the price is still pretty strong historically speaking. I mean, at $1,700. An ounce, and you know, whatever that is, about £1,250. I mean, that's pretty good. You know, historically, that's still, you know, close to historic highs.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be too pessimistic, Justin, about gold, really.
Yeah, yeah. I just think it's going to go a lot higher. I just, you know, the stimulus bills and the money printing going on. I just think, you know, there's only one way it's going, really. Yeah, there's probably a correction at the moment. Cool. All right, George. Well, listen, if people are liking the sound of what you're doing down there and you're not following the story, as always, if you could give people three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add Alba Mineral Resources to their watch list, please.
Sure. Well, Clive Ice and Davids won't surprise you. That's number one on the hit list because we're getting really good results and we're only going to carry on and we're pushing that project forward and we are doing our damnedest to get it into production in the shortest period of time. So Clogg Ice and David's Gwynfynnoth Gold Mine, which we haven't mentioned yet because we've had our hands full, but not recently anyway. So the second largest historic producer of gold in the UK's history. So in our backyard, we've got the two historic gold mines. And we know that there are serious prospects for finding gold in both of those mines that has never been produced or extracted before. So those are the top two reasons. And number three reason is Greenland, a country that's had a lot of interest in recent times. It's a strategic location. It's going to be fought over by the Chinese and the Americans and everybody else in years to come. And we have got there some really, really strong assets. In particular, I would mention Thule Black Sands, where we hope to drill this year. If we can get into Greenland and drill it and increase our tons there, move that into development. Amitsuk, our extremely high-grade graphite project in the southern tip of Greenland. And our Melville Bay iron ore project. Now, iron ore is riding high at the moment, so iron ore projects like Melville Bay are starting to be looked at in much more seriously at the moment. So we've got some strong assets in Greenland and we'll be pushing those forward this year with a bit of luck.
Marvellous stuff, George. Good to chat to you. And I can say lots going on. So no doubt we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin. Appreciate your time.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Welcome to the podcast and the video. Of course, we're live in super sort of Technicolor with Paul Hill, full-time investor and equity analyst. You all right, Paul?
Yeah, good morning, Justin. I've actually got a bit of a sore arm, so if I'm sort of like wincing a bit, and you probably understand why, it feels a bit like I've been punched in the arm. So any guesses?
Oh, I see. The missus has hit you. No, okay, no. You've had, is it AstraZeneca or Pfizer? What have you had?
I had a Pfizer yesterday. I'm 53. Hmm. I got this call from a young lady on Wednesday afternoon. We normally get crank calls, and I thought, oh, are you trying to sell me something? And she said, no, I'm trying to give you something. I said, what? You're trying to give me something? And she said, yeah. Would you like a vaccine, you and your wife? You would like an actual shot? And we said, flipping hell, that's incredible. So both of us went down sort of socially distancing to one of the healthcare clinics in Bromsgrove and, got a shot at 6 o'clock. So both of us are sort of like, looking green this morning with activity.
Yeah, last week I spoke to you. You had no sleep whatsoever because you'd been up since 11 in the night. You worked all the way through once. No, that's the difference, see. When you get older, right, things become of a different priority. Now, when you're young, you probably go out and you're partying from 11 till 4 in the morning with us and you, for example. See, you're looking at the stocks and the money markets.
Yeah,
that's what rocks our boat. And that's a different thing. But you know what? I've had the AstraZeneca one because my son's got a lung condition, so we're sort of registered carers. They called us and we said, yes, go. And we went down there. And I felt rough for 2 days afterwards. I thought I don't think COVID would make me feel this rough, but at least are you feeling a bit rough? Or it was like
other than a sore arm, it's absolutely fine. Yeah, I mean, my wife's got the same sort of thing. I mean, perfect. So hopefully in 2 weeks' time, we've got sort of some semblance of protection. But frankly, the last 12 months I've been, you know, pretty much self-isolating anyway, just in my office. So it just all works.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, when you're a stock market obsessive, you self-isolate naturally.
Really?
I'm talking up myself as well. You know, I'm finding quite easy to self-isolate. I've got the markets there. It's fine. You know, me and the market, that's fine.
I sort of typically wake up at about sort of 3:30 and then put Bloomberg on.
Yeah. I know. Same with me. I wake up sometimes and I think, do you know what I say? R&S time. I thought I sense some news on my stocks, and that. And I said to anyone, if you want to get a hobby, you know, investing is perfect. The markets are open every 5 days a week. You can do research on the weekend, but 7 a.m. deadline. R&S has come out. It's always exciting. And the markets open at 8. It's like what you're likening it to. It's like the race starts at 7, or you see the competitors at 7, and then the race starts at 8. You know, and it's always exciting. I think. But
Another one right out of sort of the top drawer, yeah, is I touch base with the guy you recommended I speak to, Miles McNulty. And I spoke to him only yesterday. I mean, the guy's razor sharp. He's only about mid-30, and I think he's done very well out of Avacta and a whole portfolio. But, I mean, it was just really sort of like I've got this big interview doing the second one to cover some of the stuff that I didn't manage to actually chat to Alistair Smith about. So we're doing third-party royalties, and he was helping me just put in the sort of questions together. So that's great with his insight and stuff.
Yeah.
But just as an example, I mean, the guy has given up work 6 years ago. He's running his own money and his own family's money, and he absolutely loves it. He's passionate about stocks. And I mean, he's, you know, he almost speaks as fast as you, Justin. So, you know, he absolutely loves it.
Well, I don't see how more people... I think we've had that during lockdown. You know, people have been sitting there, and the human... If you've got a bit of money, you think, what can I do? People couldn't go out to pubs or bars or restaurants, and they want to spend money. And so we've seen, like, gambling stocks or spread betting companies, all that. People are opening up Robin Hood accounts in America. You know, people just want to spend their money somewhere. Where's the outlet for money? And so the market has been one of those, you know. So, but I think once you get into it properly and start learning about it, I genuinely, you know, I'm interested in business, and I like that. I mean, of course, I like to make money as well, but it's almost like saying, you know, when you pick a business, you can see it's getting better and improving, and the margin's getting better, and the demand for the product getting better, and the share price will follow. And just to me, that's I find that very interesting, you know, and just reading into detail. And you pick up certain things in R&S, and think, hang on a sec, that's quite interesting. And you go back a sec and look at something else, and you just follow a rabbit warren of some, you know, of research. And I like that, you know, it's I just love that kind of stuff.
I mean, I know it's a well-trodden cliche, but in your career, you know, follow what your passion is, interested in, and the money will follow afterwards, you're obviously motivated to get up each morning because of the stock market. I'm absolutely of the same ilk. Miles is of the same ilk. Money, you know, will come through, but we're not motivated by money. We're motivated basically by good judgment, business, and just generally sort of like things changing in the world, which sort of like, it's a never-ending beast, isn't it? Just carries on going and going and going.
Exactly, it'll always be here. And and it's funny thing, you know, people realise, when you're skint, you want money, and you want to earn money and all that stuff. And then you get to a certain level, it becomes less of a worry. But, you know, Warren Buffett, for example, he's never going to stop investing until he dies. He just loves it. He doesn't need any money. He doesn't need any money for his kids, you know? So it's like, you know, he just loves the game. What would you do? It's like people say, I used to work with a guy, right, a radio station, and this newsreader said he used to hate his job. And I said, well, find a job you enjoy. And he used to like party planning and all that stuff. I said, do that. He said, well, if I won the lottery, I just wouldn't do anything. I said, you would have to do something. You may as well die. If you don't do something, you've got to do something. You can't just exist sitting on a sofa and watching TV. It's ridiculous. But anyway, hey, back to that sort of injections. Very interesting now. I've been always keeping a close eye on the hospital admissions. It's dropped off a cliff. I don't know if you saw at the peak, we were 4,600 hospital admissions a day. Now, yesterday, it was down at 532 hospital admissions from 4,600. And it's still coming down quickly. And you realise that the 80% of people who fill up the beds were over 80s. They've been done. You know, they're going to the second... So I just think they're saying that I think the data is going to be better than they expect coming forward. I mean, Israel is opened up now pretty much, isn't it? And they said they won't rush it, which is a good thing. But what are 2 months away from opening up? So
and you can see that reflecting. I mean, we've had the house builders the last couple of weeks sort of like putting out their results. And one of the stocks that, you know, I sort of follow is Taylor Wimpey. And they basically, I mean, like everybody else, they got battered last year. But frankly, they upgraded their outlook, and also the real estate experts, the likes of Savills and Knight Frank this week, said rather than, well, this is a surprise, rather than actually declining house prices this year, it's actually going to go up by 4 or 5% and another 4 or 5% in 2022. And that's largely because of, you know, obviously the government helping, extending stamp duty and the economy opening up, because the people who would have bought houses last year were obviously still in jobs, have got more bigger deposits to be able to put down, and so continue, want to carry on buying houses, and they've been helped by the government to do so. So it's not only good for the house builders, it's good for another stock I have, which is basically the, you know, a residential rental guy called Grainger. Also good for Lloyds, who do all the mortgage lending, and it's good for your stocks, which is sort of like, you know, on the market. I mean, you know, the more transactions, so it just, it's actually feeding through to the outlook.
It's funny. Do you know what? Good signal there. I'm subscribed to Rightmove, Zoopla, and On the Market, you know, sort of alerts. I got the same alerts on all of them, same criteria set up to see, you know, how competitive they are. And they're really like flight. But they literally, in January, nothing. I literally very few alerts for like first 2 weeks or 3 weeks of January. Just after January, February it was, I think it was, very quiet. Now, all of a sudden, it's starting to come alive again now. I'm starting to get several alerts. So the market, you see, there's a lot more buying activity going on, a lot more people putting their houses on the market. It's starting to free up again now. And that was because of that. Yeah, there was the worry over the stamp duty holiday not being extended. But now that's been extended.
Yeah, all they had to do was listen to this podcast, because we've talked about it for some time. They were going to flip and extend it.
Yeah.
And they're surprised they have, because it's just too important in terms of the wealth effect within the whole country for people basically recycling, you know, that money. And, you know, I was looking at the house builders, they're still not expensive. I'll just fire up the actual, you know, industry stats, yeah? But essentially, they're currently trading at about 1.6 times book, which is about reasonable. Taylor Wimpey's at about 1.6. But what they did, which was really good last year, was at the dire state of the market, they raised some money and then invested £1.3 billion at the low of the market to buy cheap land, which has absolutely rocketed their land bank from 4.8 years to 8.1 years in just 12 months. I mean, that is frankly amazing. And that's what's going to increase their return on capital employed and likewise their margins. If I was actually going to put new money into the market on house builds, I probably wouldn't do it into Taylor Wimpey, simply because I think they're trading at about fair value at the moment. But I'd put it into people like Bellway on 1.1 times. I'd put it into Redrow, which is on 1.2 times. Or, you know, even Vistry, which is at one time. So the good value still in the house builders, if you want to just pick through the pieces, because they haven't, you know, haven't increased. I mean, that's just on pure valuation grounds. So there's still plenty of opportunities. I mean, on the market, I've noticed the shares are still about £1.05 or something like that.
Yeah, well, there's not a lot of liquidity in there. So any small sales tend to knock the share price, which is quite annoying. But The only company that grows, like Rightmove, didn't grow, you know, last year, and of course the bigger company, but they did by 23%, and that's when lockdown, they give discounts. So I'm quite bullish on them. I think, you know, the SP will catch up with the fundamentals. Fundamentals, they continue to grow, I think, and it'll go forward. But in fact, you know what? Talking about being a positive predictor, you were on here a couple of weeks back, and I said bonds are boring, but you said take note of the bonds. They are the yields are starting to rise, and it'll affect the market a little bit. And we saw that, you know. Fair play, you're ahead of the game in that, because I now switch off. Now it's funny, I switch on a bit with bonds.
Are you getting a bit more interested? No, but I'll
switch off again now. It's like I wouldn't have, even with your warning on the bonds saying what's the yields they go to, I wouldn't have changed anything. I wouldn't have sold anything, you know, because you can't predict the wobble. But it's seeming to. Calm down a bit now. The initial sort of volatility has gone out, isn't it? It's the rotation.
Hey, matey, I'll tell you, if I was going to recommend one thing you should learn, every investor should learn about, even though they're not going to go anywhere near it, is the bond market.
No, but hang on. If you're an investor, you should know about equities first, surely, not bonds.
No, exactly. But you need to understand the bond market to understand equities. The bond market is bigger.
No, I know that.
It's bigger than the stock market in the global, And what it tells you is that where is the smart, more smart money
going? Well, the big money, isn't it? It's the institutions.
Yeah, and it can tell a lot of things in terms of where it's trading, in terms of price, in terms of, you know, sort of discount to actually its par value, in terms of how it could knock valuations going forward. So it's absolutely crucial.
So keep it simple then. Okay, right now, if I'm looking at one bond, what am I looking at? 10-year Treasury yield.
10-year US Treasuries is the big at the moment.
If you're looking at that, so what's happening with that then at the moment?
Well, it's increasing simply because everybody's expecting the economies to open up, the US and the UK. And on the basis of that, they're expecting break-even inflation rates to rise, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why yield is increasing is because if inflation's going up, yeah, in real terms, bond yields have to go up just to stay steady, just to stay the same in real terms, okay? So let's say, for instance, you're projecting a break-even inflation rate in the US of 2%. It's slightly higher, but let's say 2%, yeah? The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 1.5%. You're still going to lose, in real terms, half a percent per annum. And therefore, every other tick up, basis point tick up in that yield is either going to make a bigger negative for you in real terms, or you increase the yield. And that's, it's just frankly like a seesaw.
But they're saying that this inflation is even the Fed head, I don't know how much you can believe from him, but saying it's short-lived. It's a rebound.
Don't give me that rubbish. It's not transient. And the reason why it's not transient...
What, so is he lying? Are you saying Jerome Powell's lying, Paul?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, you heard it.
And the reason
Paul Hill saying the head of the Fed is lying.
Exactly. Now, I'm not having a go at any of the central bankers yet, because they've got a really tough act. All I would say is that just look at the level of government debt in the world. The only way we're ever going to get out of this on the long term is continued low to mid-single digit inflation above 2% on an ongoing basis. And that will, in real terms, get the GDP to the nation's debt ratio back into tilter, rather than actually just ratcheting up all taxes. That's the only way we're going to do it, and that's what happened after the war. So you know, we know the movie. That's what happens. Inflation has to go up.
But do you know why bonds? But do you know why bonds will never be very popular amongst private investors? You know why?
I'm not saying invest in them. I'm saying you've got to.
No, I know. But do you know why people won't get interested in them? Because people have a limited amount of time, right? They want to know how to earn money in stocks. Pretty much, most people don't have a big pot. Most people have an average or small-sized pot. And the only way you can do that is with smaller caps, right? They haven't got time to mess around with bonds. They're too busy researching. Most people are going to work 9 to 5, whatever, or even longer than that. The only time they've got to sort of research, they're not going to look into bonds. They're going to look into what's next hot stock, you know?
That's not possibly, all. Anyway.
I know.
Possibly.
I don't sit down with a big book of bonds and they just want to, what's the next stuff? How can I make money? You know, it's like, you know, there's a guy out there, there's a bear case for the market. And there's lots of bears out there. But you can understand, people are not, only people with lots and lots of money are worried about losing their money. Most people want to make money. You know, it's the bull case most people want to chase, not the bear case. So, you know, you've got a bigger market if you're appealing to the bull side, because people want to make money. Okay, we don't want to lose money, but most people starting off don't have a lot to lose anyway. They just want to make money, you know?
You've got the perfect example of that is Avacta, isn't it? And we've come back full circle and stuff, and the shares have actually gone up sort of 6, 7, 8, even 10 times over the past 12 months. But frankly, the roadway the runway ahead is absolutely massive still on that company. And they came out with news this week saying their rapid flow antigen test covers the new COVID variants, which is fantastic news. And the reason why that is really important.
Can you share my screen on there or not? I can't share screen. Can you host
it? No, don't bother. It's okay. I know they're about 2, but the shares have gone up another 10.
I know, but 15. People on video, I just want to show them the chart because it's quite volatile, but it's gone up quite a lot. But
the reason why that is really important is twofold. Firstly, is because it's showcasing its Affimer diagnostics technology to the world in numerous application areas, showing the flexibility and the applicability of it. And two, it means that they can actually, or should be able to, engineer these Affimers to be able to hang off any spike protein of the coronavirus, or in fact, any other antigen or other virus, yeah? Such that effectively, you can then amplify the effect of having an Affimer against the reagent. I mean, the science is very simple. Even I can understand it. It's if basically you get a nasty antigen in your bloodstream or in a particular cell, and existing tests don't pick it up. Hence the accuracy of a lateral flow. A traditional lateral flow is very poor. But if you hang something to it, like a big spotlight called an Affimer, mm-hmm. and get the Avobiat reagent, you amplify what that signal comes from the antigen, from the spike protein, and therefore you're bound to pick up more of them because you get the, you know, effectively the higher accuracy rate. So it's twofold. One, it showcases the whole technology across the world, and also it means that it's actually future-proofed because effectively if you can actually engineer these Affimers to hit the spike protein, then and different variants, then frankly you've got an accurate lateral flow. Anyway, we're not quite there yet. Clinical data has been very good on the accuracy. We'll hear the final bits and pieces towards the end of, well, I think it's the end of March, early April, etc. So, and I know I'm not going to cover that in the call with the interview with Alistair on Monday, but we're going to basically do the third party royalties. But with the showcasing, they actually did sign another deal on the diagnostic side with a German company called BioKit, and they're IVD, basically in vitro diagnostics business, healthcare largely, and they do rapid tests for glandular fever, STDs, and rheumatoid arthritis already, interestingly. So why not hang a flipping Affimer off one of these conditions to be able to get a faster and more accurate test in these areas? So it just shows you, even to an idiot like me, the technology is massively applicable to lots and lots of different areas. And I think that's what will come. And just looking at the valuation, coming full circle, the valuation is underpinned just by the rapid flow test, in my view, as an investor. I don't own shares. And then you've got basically the precision platform, which is effectively the chemo technology, which allows treating cancer, etc. And also the Affimer therapeutics and diagnostic. You get that for free. And when I was speaking to Miles, we were both sort of like, you know, on the same page. If they can, if the company can actually get to commercial, you know, sort of like phase success on phase two, phase three trials for these things. I mean, you could see the shares, you could see the tenfold again. It would not be out of this world to have a £6-8 billion business here from a £600-700 million business currently, just because the technology and the addressable markets are absolutely massive. So I'm hugely excited about speaking to Alistair again and going through the royalties because, frankly, I think they say the runway for this business is enormous and is actually, if they hit any of those, you know, sort of like bases, is not priced into it. So going back to your where you can make money, I mean, lots of people have made lots of money, and I know Miles has already, but he is really positive about the business, and I think rightly so as well.
Yeah. Well, no, he's done very well. One thing I would say is when, do you know what, I want to talk about this actually, about sellers. And sellers generally, you get institutions and holding stock, and they'll start selling, and I've heard quite a few times. In fact, one time I actually wrote a paragraph to give a stock answer. Lots of people kept asking the same thing, saying, well, if the institution is selling, there must be something wrong. And I said, well, first of all, the institutions don't have insider knowledge, not allowed to. They'd go to jail if they did. So, they've got, of course, bigger research time and budget and staff than you have, so they can look into a company more. But generally, every time I've seen a seller company, whether it's a private individual or institution, it's not specific to the company. Generally, you know, these institutions will hold 100 different companies, and sometimes it's just change of policy, change of management, the market caps drop down or whatever. It's more in-house thing or a personal thing rather than anything to do with the company. And in fact, 99% of the time it's to do with the personal policy of the company or the person rather than the company they're selling. Is that, in your experience, the same?
It isn't actually personal. What it is largely is just size positioning. So it's portfolio and risk management.
When I say personal, I mean to the person that high net worth, or I mean it's specific to the fund themselves, not the business they're invested in. You know, like you say, it's rotation.
Well, I mean,
stocks.
What happens? Let's just take for Avacta, for instance. Yeah, the shares have gone from, I think there was a low of, they did a placing at about 12 months ago at about, I don't know, 15, 12p or something like that. There are now like over £2, and Gervase Williams, the biggest shareholder, has been top slicing because it's gone from about 3 or 4% of his portfolio. If it held the lot, it went to about 15-20%, and that is just too much against against the portfolio's sort of conditions and allowances in terms of risk management. He just can't get that big, so he has to.
Yeah.
So he's forced for no reason to sell and to top slice. He's still the largest shareholder. But he's apt to sell simply because, you know, it's just from risk management side. And frankly, I've been in the same boat in the fact I've had big positions. The stock's done out pretty well. And I've struggled selling. And when I have, when you can't do a cross trade against another fund manager, you're faced with putting it onto the market. And I've personally taken share prices down 10, 15, 20% because, you know, you put a big chunk in and it can't absorb it quickly. So that's it, you know. You'll be the same. If you ever decide to escape from escape hunt, you'll struggle selling 3% of those shares, I can promise you.
But my someone asked me this on our weekly webinar with my, you know, investment club, and I said, At the moment, I don't see them, you know, priced in. The potentials are priced in there. They're priced at about 18, 17 sites over there, the way they are. The digital side's not priced in, or any expansion's not priced in, and I still am quite happy holding these. And if it gets to this stage where I think by the time I start selling, it'll be a lot more liquid, a lot bigger, and they'll, you know, and so I may even be diluted down through sort of, you know, other stuff and everything. But yeah, I'm not worried at the moment because I'm holding on to them. But yeah, I mean, it's a personal thing. You say there, it's a risk management thing. But also, I've seen institutions sell companies because, you know, you've seen a company like Startup or IPO. They've gone up, a bit of hype, come back down, and then their market cap has gone below a certain level. And so some funds will just say, we don't deal with companies below 50 million market cap, or it's too illiquid, and they just get out, and they start dumping. And so they don't care about the business. The business could be at an inflection point, coming around and starting to generate cash or whatever now, but it doesn't matter for them, does it? And it's happened recently, actually, with Gfinity. It's a big high net worth in that. And he's moved his funds out. But he's been in there for a while. He held a big chunk of shares, and he's had a lot of profit. And he's also a little bit very keen on another company. He wants to reallocate a bit of cash. And he said, I still like them. He's got 40 million warrants in Gfinity. And he said, I still like them. It's just I want to put some more money in this company. And so, again, don't be scared out. I mean, there's a trouble sometimes. I've just jumped out of stocks on a whim, because I've been panicky or something when I first started off. But you realise after a while, don't get scared out. If the business is improving, that's all you need to concentrate on. You know, if the business itself is improving, the SP will catch up in the end, you know?
Yeah. Well, spill the beans 2 weeks ago. You were saying you were sort of like lining up another purchase.
No, I will. So next,
my appetite, at
this
least.
This time next week, I'll be... The thing is, I've got...
Ah, you're not going to keep me on the edge of the gate, are you?
Listen, now, this time next week...
Pull the trigger!
I've got a membership site, and I've given... They have a month exclusivity on any new stock I talk about. I give them a month of challenge. Yeah.
So, spill the beans, mate.
But this time next week, I'll tell you. And I'll tell you what, actually. It's connected to one of the stocks you hold. It's an agreement between this company and one of the stocks you own, which is a big stock, which is, we were talking last week about its validation sometimes. When a big, well-known company hooks up with a small-cap company, it's validation of the product that company has.
Okay, so it hooked up with Merck, did it?
No.
With Grainger?
No.
Gilead?
I'm not going to say no. It's not a medical company, but it's a well-known company, one of the biggest well-known companies hooked up with this smaller company. But I'll read it next week. I'm also looking at another company at the moment, but again, it's one of those things where I'm at the stage now.
Have you got any cash left?
Well, again, I haven't got a huge amount of cash, but I'm rotating a little bit, you know, it's companies, and I'll just reallocate again. It's reallocating. You know, certain stocks, I think, okay. And it's about, again, someone asked me, when do you sell a company? And to me, there's only, you know, there was three reasons, I can't think of the third, but the one of the ones is stories changed, you know? It's always ended in some way. Yeah, it's not sticking to the story.
The thesis doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Secondly, reallocation of capital. You know, if you see a company you think you can get better returns on, then it's hard to know this because a lot of it is subjective, of course. But if you think you can, it gets to the stage, you research it and you think, no, I see a compelling case for this, you know, almost doubling within this year. And this company, I can't see doubling maybe in the next 3-4 years.
You sound like a value investor.
No, but do you know what I'm saying? So that is a reason why. It's just about, you know, is your better money, you know, better allocated to a different company?
I'll tell you what the third reason is, Justin, when you can't remember. The bond market goes up.
that's why I didn't know it. That's why I forgot, you know, the bond market goes up. But there's a third reason. I'll find you what it was. I'll do a video on that.
There was a company this morning that I own quite a big chunk of, you know, sort of like Northbridge Industrial, small cap.
Yeah.
They're only about sort of 30, 40 million. They had a change at the top. And again, you can read in negatives or read in positives. But frankly, it was just the guy is... Eric Hook, the CEO, is 68. He's retired. He's been working there for like 15 years as a CEO. He's the founder. and he's finally decided to sort of pass on the baton. So the non-exec chairman, Peter Harris, is taking over. Nothing untoward whatsoever.
Share price has gone up.
Well, the thing is...
That can't be good. When you're a CEO, you step down, the share price goes up.
It's absolutely fine. And the reason is because Eric is not leaving the company. He's going to stay as a strategic advisor to the business. He's maintaining all his shares in there, which just shows that he thinks the prospects for the company are very good. And he's going to be on a sort of like a call as the company needs it basis. And frankly, the guy is 68. He should be enjoying his retirement. So it's a massive sort of like, it just shows you how he really thinks the business could do well going forward. And I'm on the same page. I mean, the shares are about 105, something like that this morning. They're still cheap. My fair value is at 175. But I mean, I've said this before and I feel like a broken record. This could go to 2, 3, 4 quid over the next 2 to 3, 4 years. And the reason is, sales are being driven by renewable energy, data center growth, instability in the grid network, carbon capture, carbon reduction, yeah? And, you know, basically pent-up demand because the projects have been pushed to the right. So there's masses of tailwinds for this business. And also, you know, if you want any data point, just look at what's happened in the States. California, they've had droughts. They've got rolling power blackouts. You need basically Crestix load banks to help service all those uninterruptible power supplies. And Texas had a massive deep freeze. And I mean, the disruption of power blackouts was absolutely immense. So people getting sacked and stuff. So you need their technology. And as I say, the Tasman with carbon capture, blue hydrogen, I mean, it just got all the best of sort of ESG involved there. So the long-term horizon is quite good. The only problem I would say is actually, if you want a chunky number, you've got to be pretty patient. It's quite illiquid. So when this moves, it's going to move pretty sharpish. It could go from £1.05 to £1.50 pretty damn quick on not much, on just a breath of fresh air, essentially.
I'd say simplify it. First of all, call it. Start from the top, the name. Don't call it Northbridge Industrial Services. It's too long. Start with Northbridge. Then, secondly, there's two bits of the business, isn't there? And I think, which is the best bit there? Which is the best bit of that business?
The crown jewel is definitely, in my opinion, Crestix. Yeah, but let's be clear about it. If Tasman's being driven by blue hydrogen and by carbon capture going forward and carbon reduction, then that's a pretty bloody good. That's a good business anyway. But yeah, the real crown jewel is the Crestix side, no doubt.
Spin off the other one. Just call it Crestix.
No, there's a synergy. Well, yeah, well, they might do that. I don't know.
But just, I mean, I think as far as the guys inside know everything about it. You know everything about it. You're a deep research guy, you know, but even now you talk to me about it, and I can't think, oh, there's two bits to this. It can't be complex,
Justin.
Do you know what? I'm a simple guy. I like a simple story.
It's not linked to the bond market. It can't be complex.
I like a simple story, right? When you're selling a company or promoting a company, it has to be a simple story that you catch on to. And when you've got two split stories, it straight away complicates it. I know it's very hard. I just think, you know, what's the best part of the business? If you had to sell one part, what would it be? What would you keep? You know, if you had to keep one of them, what would the side would it be? And that's investing. Like I said, most people who are investing don't do it full time. They have a limited amount of time. And so to get it, that's why simple stories, almost blue sky, simple narratives really work. And I look at stocks sometimes, it'll fly, and think, why are people buying that? And you realize it's just a dream. The hope, hype, potential of that stock sells very well. It's very simple. And I've seen companies valued at several hundred million. Shouldn't be valued anywhere near that. And you think, but the hope, hype, potential just driven the price right up because it's an easy sell. You know, people on Twitter are pumping it. It's an easy sell. And that's why Northbridge, in actual fact, should be valued a lot higher than this. It's just the story is a little bit complex, and even starting with Northbridge Industrial Services is a mouthful, you know.
I've actually suggested to the board they have a look at the name, so I didn't
simplify it all.
Anyway, other corporate news that I've talked about before. Source Bio, basically picked up a contract with fantastic news for me, England Rugby. So basically, they're doing all the PCR, and that means that obviously they won't have any more cancelled games for the Premiership and the Championship and for the England team. So that's great. And again, what it does is the direction of travel. Once you get the endorsement, they want it from a competitor, actually. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it shows you that their service is absolutely top draw. And there's going to be masses and masses of testing going off. I mean, just look at basically, my, as I say, my wife works at school, you know, and they're all, they've all gone back this week. They're all doing at school lateral flow, but from next week or next Tuesday onwards, all the lateral flow tests will be done at home. Now, what happens, yeah, if somebody gets a positive lateral flow test at the moment, you know, after Tuesday, is that then they've got to confirm using a PCR to make to see whether it's actually right. So that will help. At the moment, because I think the industry is pretty short of PCR tests, it means the rest of their classmates and people who have been in contact to that person who was positive also has to quarantine for 10 days. What a waste of resource that is. Mm. And therefore, it won't be long if the if there's sufficient capacity before those people who potentially needlessly have to quarantine and with work and stuff can then get a PCR as well. So PCR, I mean, you know, the industry for the next 3 months is going to be absolutely flying as the economy reopens, people go on holiday, start going out, get the schools go back as it does so. And then the long-term trajectory for the whole COVID testing, and I know, you know, sort of like lots of people are sort of like speculating where it is, but I just said, just point yourselves to Boston Consulting Group, and they reckon there's going to be, this is going to be, it's one of the key pillars. The first pillar being vaccines, second pillar being continued testing, and the third pillar being a blockbuster or breakthrough therapeutic to help people who have been in hospital. And that's what you need. The last bit we haven't got yet, we're getting there. And the second with the testing is just going to carry on for ages.
Yeah, I still think we are now edging here on the side of caution a little bit. And what annoys me as well, they keep talking about infection rates, looking at infection rates. That now, in my mind, is largely irrelevant. When you did have a vaccine, infection rates were very relevant because there were people who were unprotected who would die and they'd end up in hospital. So the more the infection would go up, of course, that would filter through to everyone, and especially the most vulnerable who would fill up hospital beds. Now that isn't the case. You know, these people are protected.
No, you're kidding yourself.
Hang on, let me say one thing. But when you see an infection in school, for example, it is literally, it's becoming now like the flu because we are getting a vaccine. We've got a third of the population vaccinated, pretty much. And, you know, of those, the most vulnerable who will fill up hospital beds. That's the reason why we're locked down. That's the reason why we're locked down the economy, because it overwhelms the NHS. Those people aren't going to fill up those
hospitals. You're kidding yourself, Justin. What about your kids who've got asthma, okay? They get COVID.
I genuinely think at the moment, if you look at the effect on those people, it's not. It's like there's people with weak... My son is not. He's got a lung condition, but he's not got a weak immune system. Okay, and so I just genuinely think...
How many people in the world have got a weakened immune system?
No, but as soon as they're protected, though, and then most of them are, we are getting to that stage.
No, they're not!
We will be within a couple of months, we'll be there.
No, if you think about it, okay.
Everyone will be vaccinated by June, July.
Justin, this is it. This is absolutely crucial to understanding the whole pandemic or endemic, as it's going to be. For those people who have a weakened immune system, you give them a vaccine, their immune system is not going to produce antibodies to fight off COVID, because that's the whole thing of having a weakened immune system. You can't produce the antibodies that the vaccine is supposed to stimulate, because that's the whole purpose of it. And the problem you get is that you only get like 15% response or 20% response to the vaccine. And the worst part of it, it then acts as an incubation petri dish for COVID variants. And that's what's happened in South Africa and the Amazonian rainforest. It isn't coincidence that these guys have weakened immune systems and the worst variants are there, because you the body never kills these things off. They just stay in there for 30, 40 days, just mutating. And that's the problem. People think that it's a silver bullet on the vaccine. It is for...
No, but hang on. What about, for example, that's the same though, isn't it, with the flu? It mutates in variations all the time. So, I mean, the vaccines are there, widely available now, of course. So it'll be in that sort of ballpark, wouldn't it? Where we, you know, everyone can't be protected. Of course they can't. But that's the same with any virus, you know?
No, it isn't. Because this one's pretty deadly. If you think about...
No, it's not. If you see the mutations of the variants, as you've had this, even with the variants, they said serious illness, it's cut out serious illness, even with variants. And even Pfizer said, we can tweak the vaccine 100 days for any variant.
Yes, but your immune system is not going to respond if it's weaker. Just think, there's 4% of the world's population, at least, who have a weakened immune system. 4% of 7.5 billion, okay, is roughly round about, what, 300,000? It's about 300 million people, okay? Yeah, worldwide.
Yeah, but...
They're the guys who are going to go into hospital. 300 million at least. Just look at what's happened in Brazil with their variant, because most of the population can't fight it.
No, but they Brazil haven't vaccinated as many as other countries.
No, but if you gave them a vaccine, it wouldn't make any difference. Because
it does. Have you seen the results on that? Have you seen the results on the variants? Even with in Israel, they've looked at it, even with variants.
Israel.
It's mild disease, yes, but
Israel, yeah, but not Brazil.
One thing is because they haven't hit that percentage of vaccinated population yet in Brazil. So even with new variants, they're showing there's less incidence of severe disease, even if you've got a new variant. You know, so it doesn't even kill off, you know, people. So you'll be ill, yes, you will. You'll be ill, but won't be severely ill.
Okay, can I just suggest one thing? Yeah, we'll park it. Just have a look at Novavax's statement when they came out with their trial results, okay? 95% efficacy, okay? But for the South African variant, okay, surprise, surprise, it came down, which makes sense for just the normal population, but it absolutely plummeted for that same variant for people with weakened immune system with AIDS. It went below 50%. Saying to me and the medical
world...
So that
would cut half the people out. So half the people, even with a weakened immune system, would be fine.
Okay.
So that would bring down hospitalisation.
150 million people in hospital. No,
about 150 million people around the world. That's not a lot. That's not to fill up our NHS system.
Only double the UK population. Yeah,
but you're talking about 181 countries. We're not talking about UK. We're talking about 100, divided by 181 countries. And that's not going to overwhelm our NHS, is it?
Okay, we'll park it.
No, hang on, let me just see that. How many 150 million, you reckon, right? Divided by 181. That's 828 people per country.
Well, let's just park it. It just
so there we are. It's true. It's honestly, and they'll tweet that. They'll have these tweets every now. Now we're getting to the stage where you've got Pfizer already, AstraZeneca already working on variants, and of course, the coronavirus has been around for a year now, so we're going to have variants. The flu has variants every year, but we'll be up to speed on this within months, a year, whatever variants. There'll be variants all the time. It's amazing. I genuinely think within months. I mean, you see the figures dropping off a cliff, and we haven't even got to the. There will be everyone will be vaccinated in this country by the end of July. They're saying. Now, the variants will come out again then, so we'll have new vaccines every year rolling around.
Okay. But if you've got, all I'd say, just have a look at things. If you've got a transplant, yeah, you've got a kidney, liver, or whatever it is, anything where, or even AIDS or anything like that, your immune system is absolutely shot to pieces, whether it's through the drugs you get or just naturally because of the actual disease. And on that basis, you have no immunity or hardly any immunity to any virus, okay? If you get COVID, regardless if you've had a vaccine, because you wouldn't have produced, your immune system will not.
Yeah, but
not
sadly,
be able to
you can't produce every. You can't predict everyone. That's. No, I mean, virus is horrible.
But... It's not predicting it. You give them anything, any vaccine, just by definition, a vaccine triggers an immune response to create antibodies. Mm. If your immune system is compromised, or even shot to bits, or doesn't work, it ain't going to give you the protection that it's supposed to give, even if in a normal person it gives you 100% efficacy.
Okay, let's agree on this. Okay, let's agree. So that you're saying antivirals, but they're coming through anyway.
Yes, that's what you need, antivirals.
That's why you're invested in...
That's the silver bullet, okay? Much harder.
I know, we are getting there, though, aren't we, quickly?
Yeah, Glaxo coming out like this week saying that it's actually got another monoclonal antibody treatment. 85% efficacy for people who are sort of like mild, who are vulnerable to going into hospital, but only have mild conditions. So you have to treat it early. There's no real drug at the moment to be able to treat people who are hospitalised or really, really effective. Remdesivir is the best still probably than anything else. Just for somebody who's actually, pretty much on their deathbed. And then it's just shot. It's just basically potluck whether they, you know, they get a chance.
No, I know it sounds awful and mercenary, obviously, but there's
always sound awful.
There's always going to be people with immune systems that can't, you know, deal with viruses. There's always going to be.
You're a hard man. You're a hard man.
No, there is, isn't it? I mean, if I had an immune system, and you know, hopefully I would be saying, you know, I wouldn't be saying, you know, keep the entire world locked down because I'm not going to survive. Because essentially, you can't do that. You can't kill everyone else's life. It doesn't stop. You know, because that's always going to be the case. It's always going to be. So hopefully, science will help these people. But yes. You know, and it's, we're getting there. But yes. We're always going to have casualties of. You know, it's almost a war. It's a war, isn't it? You know, it's a virus war. So there's only.
And just bring it again, sort of full circle. Yeah, the other company that came out with good sort of news this week was Verici, and they are absolutely sort of like they would rubber stamp what we've just discussed because they do immunodiagnostics for cancer transplants. Sorry, cancer for kidney transplants globally. Okay, and part of that whole. Patient journey. When a patient actually receives a transplant, they actually have to have huge immunosuppressants. So they are really in danger. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of kidney transplant operations around the world have been pushed to the right, because frankly, it's so dangerous. The problem you have now is, one, you've got a massive backlog, and people, if you're on a dialysis machine, your effectively survival rate in the first 5 years, 50, you know, up to 50% of people die in 5 years, okay? So they need a transplant to get off the dialysis machines. And there's masses of more who aren't even on the waiting list who would benefit from this. And that just shows you that these immune suppressants are really dangerous when it comes to things, nasty viruses like COVID, where your immune system will not respond properly to a, you know, to a vaccine. Anyway, they've entered their immunodiagnostic lead tests, have entered clinical validation trials with three medical hospital and medical centers out in the US, and they're hoping to complete all those studies by the end of the year, and that will be a massive step change. And I've flagged this before, we've got the treatments, like if you go from cancer, you go basically to immunotherapies and the new stuff coming through. Immunodiagnostics, that whole diagnostics area, is about 5 to 10 years behind, but now going into the effect of the 21st century. And these guys are one of the leaders. They're not making any sales at the moment, but given the level of their clinical efficacy and the industry backing of Mount Sinai, and just look at their advisory board, it's leading edge. It's absolutely. I mean, I think if you ever, ever want to invest in life sciences, big pharma, big biotech, anybody like that, follow where the science is. Is what go invest in companies that have the best science, and that's certainly the, you know, the greatest advice I've ever been given when it comes to sort of like you know, healthcare or even technology, you know, basis. And that's why I had a guy on Twitter saying, you know, you talked about Glaxo with this breakthrough potential mono antibody therapeutic. Is your view changed on Glaxo? And it hasn't, because I actually think, and this is my own personal opinion, the science in Glaxo is not as good as the competitors, frankly, as that. Like, you know, Moderna and
the
Pfizer.
The share price is saying that as well. I mean, the share price is at the 2011 low. But
exactly.
Can I ask you a question? I talked about this with Russ actually recently, and I was saying that if you look at that, and if you figure that, you know, buy low, sell high is the most simple, the most enduring, you know, phrase in the stock market. They're at now a 2011 low, pretty much. That's where they are.
Yeah.
So, but they've got the money and the resources, surely, to turn this around and going forward. You know,
I'm not sure they have. I mean, I would love to think so, because they're a great leader for English, you know, medical science. But frankly, they are light. Their science has been proved. Certainly their vaccine business, it was the world's number one or world number two before the pandemic, has been proved. It's just way behind. I mean, mRNA technology is just so far ahead of it. And the Novavax one is so far. I mean, if you've got AstraZeneca, had nothing to do with vaccines, you know, sort of like basically teaming up with Oxford University and producing something that's actually going to work worldwide, and Glaxo are nowhere to be seen.
Yeah.
I mean, it just says a lot. I mean, I actually think that is a value trap, and I still believe it is. And I hate to say it, because I like Glaxo. I would love to buy it, but if you're actually, you know, sort of like led by where the science is, their cancer division is so far behind the likes of Merck. Their vaccine business is, as we said, was so far behind. And then all they've got then is an over-the-counter business that frankly sells toothpaste.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so. And that's an expensive valuation for a toothpaste
seller. Exactly. I know.
But do you know what? It's funny you say that. But do you know what? I think what we both agree on is, you know, don't bet against human innovation. It's amazing. And what we've done with the vaccines in this last 12 months.
I've learned my lesson.
Phenomenal.
I've learned my lesson.
Yeah, but just phenomenal what we've done, isn't it? When you go back to like 1918 and the Spanish flu and how long it took to get a vaccine back then, and right now, you know, what we've done there is phenomenal. And, with charts, with some of the chart of Glaxo, you just got to look at the chart and realise, do you know what? It's something wrong there. And when that chart starts to pull around, then maybe the business is going to follow that. But, definitely. And I wouldn't buy anything, like I said, because it's oversold, you know, because when you see an oversold position, it can carry on being oversold. And especially big companies, if you look at BT, for example, it can be oversold for years and it can keep dragging it down for years and years and years. So you've got to look at the business there as well. But
you've got to look at is there a catalyst? Is there a fundamental change in it? Is there something that will trigger a reviewing of the whole company? And when it's in science, whether it's medical or high tech, I would also always say go to the best players, go to the people who have got the best technology as an investment thesis. Don't go to the worst and think they're going to be able to turn it round. Because I'll tell you, here's a question for you, Justin. It should be an easy one for somebody your immense, sort of intellectual capacity. Again,
go on.
What is the toughest part of making a successful pharma or biotech? I mean, what is the critical element that is required to do it? Okay.
Wow. Well, first of all, let me say, I've looked at this, the clinical trials. If you doing clinical trial stuff, it's very expensive, and you've got to get it right. It costs a lot of money, and then it's got to get to the commercial stage. You know, but I don't know what's the most. What are you talking about? Which
I'll give
stage?
You an big company? I'll give you the answer. Okay, it's people. You've got to have the best scientists, the best experts in that therapeutic area to deliver the best results. Okay, and how do you get that? You cannot just buy it in because these people are in short supply. Okay, and on that basis, that's on your critical path. If you're going to turn a business around, you need the best scientists, the best medics, the best experts. And frankly, Glaxo has demonstrated it hasn't got it at the moment, and it won't be able to get it overnight by just throwing dollars either, unless it buys a business that has it and hopefully and just hopes that those people stay with it.
Maybe it should buy Verici, maybe.
Well, there you go. The problem is it will cost them a lot more to buy if they want that link with Mount Sinai in New York, I promise you.
Yeah, no, in fact, looking at that Verici chart, it rocketed up, you know, since IPO, what IPO, 20 pence or something. And then
it took off,
topped out, double topped at 93 pence. Now it's come out to 68 pence. So it's coming around now and calming down a bit, the chart is calming down. So maybe it's a good time to start looking at it, you know?
What's happened is because of the you're asking for a battering, you are, Justin. Because of the bond yields have gone up, the whole sector has come down. Okay, and the big granddaddy in the sector is CareDx, its biggest competitor, who does all this, you know, sort of like diagnostic stuff for transplants. It's worth about $2 billion, but that's fallen over the last month. When I last looked at it, by over 40% compared to Verici, which had sold off by about a third in that same period. So it's actually gone down less than the leader in the market. It's just really, it went up because of the bond yields going down in terms of that.
No, my stocks are hammering. I mean, my electric vehicle sort of exposure plays, like was Ilika and TrackWise, took a bit of a hit when Tesla took a bit of a knock as well. One of the biggest.
Do you own Tesla?
No, I don't own Tesla. No, I'm just saying with Tesla and EV.
You've
just
got a fleet of their vehicles
They tend to move in sentiment, yes, you know, with Tesla. And Tesla sold off last couple of weeks because of bond yields and that stuff. But it had a big rally this week, 20% up in one day. And now, again, track-wise and Ilika are starting to move again up positively. You know, but generally, I never look at bond yields. I just look at individual companies. I know they're going to have ups and downs. That's the stock market. You can't look at every moving part, you know? Just
no,
concentrate.
I'd agree, yeah.
And also, as I said, you can almost get too bearish. The macro is essentially bearish. All it is you're looking at sometimes is just bearish all the time. There's always bearish commentators out there. So just look at your own stocks and think, you know, okay, understand how the macro plays into it. But you know, don't get shaken out of a stock because you worry about, well, the bond yield's going to hammer this stock. Because if it's got lots of potential, I just think, you know, I can't look at every part.
I'll just say, Paul. I hate to say it, Justin, but I actually agree with you. I made that classic mistake last year. I remember having this conversation on our podcast, and I was saying, well, I've had a really good look at my portfolio when I had, looking at those I didn't think going to get through the COVID valley. And so I was basically directed by my head. And sometimes, just sometimes, you need to be directed by your heart, your intuition.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what?
And your gut feel.
Since that Dash for Cash back in March 2020, you know, I just had Russ Mole on, actually. He said, the FTSE 350, only 11 stocks are down since that Dash for Cash. And that's because they've gone up and kind of got down. But most of them, only 11 stocks. The rest of them are all up. So fear is our friend sometimes. And sometimes when you get really bearish, maybe it's time to get in there, you know? I mean, apart from you're at the top of the market, you know? I mean,
And sometimes you've got to use your gut feel rather than your head. Anyway, it's one of those things. It costs me a shed load.
Yeah. Well,
I was just thinking 12 months ago in March, I mean, I lost a lot of bread, you know, seven figures. So it was a painful time. But now my portfolio is back to just about where it was, you know, over 12 months ago. So, you know, no problem at all. And it's not up or anything like that, but it's getting that way. And I learned a lesson. You can be too rational sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes I do valuations of companies and I think, well, do you know what? And then all of a sudden I see stocks, you know, nothing compared to the stock I'm holding, for example. They're just rallying on hope, hype, potential. And, you know, a lot of people just buy into it and think, well, sometimes. But you've always got to have that base level of valuation, I think. But I think macro sometimes we can get to, I got too bearish as well. And I got really into looking at silly things I shouldn't be looking at. I think focus on the stocks, maybe have a look at the macro as well, but focus on the stocks and do more research on the smaller stocks, on the stocks.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing your research in 2 weeks' time when we repeat this and you reveal your latest purchase.
Mm. It's doing well already. I mean, if you're part of my members club, you'd be...
Oh, yeah, well, I don't mind.
Marvellous. Listen, check this out on video if you want to. Subscribe if you want the next video to your inbox. And, of course, we'll speak to you next week. Cheers, Paul. Thanks very much.
Have a great weekend, guys.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You're Russ.
Yeah, I'm very well, Justin. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Chatting off mic there. We're saying, literally, you know, the Dash for Cash was this time last year. Time is flying, like, crazy. That seems... I can't believe that was last year now. It was a year away, wasn't it?
What made me think of it was next week is Cheltenham Festival Week.
Yeah.
Big jump festival for horse racing. Obviously, there was lots of debate last year as to whether it was the right thing to do to allow 250,000 people to go to the Cotswolds and back, including lots of, you know, very loyal Irish punters. And I guess that debate might still rumble in the background. But clearly next week, there'll be no punters in the Cotswolds at all, but they're still running that prestigious meeting. And that made me think of it, because just after Cheltenham, the FTSE 100 bottomed at 4994 on the 23rd of March. So we're already coming up to a year after the market bottomed. So I just thought it might be instructive just to have, and this is the bit I'm really good at, right, telling people what's happened. But, I mean, there are some lessons to be drawn from it, potentially, all the same.
And do you know what? It's like every two charts I looked at, you realise that sometimes the market's fear. When you get that much fear, fear is your friend as an investor. If you've got spare cash, you can chuck it into any stock, pretty much, and you will do quite well. Because price is a lot. Getting the right price is half the battle, isn't it?
This is it. I mean, we know that some companies are structurally wounded and their shares will wither. But if you bought... I mean, I've just done the numbers for the 350, but that bottomed on the same day. Mm-hmm. If you just scattergunned it, of the FTSE 350 stocks that are there now, there's only 11 that are down over the last 12 months. So you'd have had to work quite hard to find them. And all right, but just so you know who they are,
they're
Unilever, Rolls-Royce, Pennon, Glaxo, Centamin, Hiscox, Hammerson, HSBC, Tesco, Petrofac, and Babcock.
Wow.
And so, Tesco may be a bit of a fluke because of the share consolidation, so I'll probably need to cut them a little bit of slack. And yeah. they've also done the special dividend as well. But nevertheless, I think just looking at that list, it's intriguing. What for all, you know, you'd think, oh, a year ago, well, consumer staples, Unilever, yeah, check, I'll ship in some of that. Glaxo Pharmaceuticals, yeah, check, I'll ship in some of that. But, you know, Pennon Utility, yeah, have a bit of that, thank you very much. But it actually hasn't worked out. HSBC banks, we know, have been under fierce pressure because of quantitative easing and the crushing of the yield curve and squeeze net interest margins. And HSBC is the meat in the sandwich between the rest of the world and China as well at the moment. So that's just intriguing that you could have gone for safety. And just in the bottom 20, you've also got National Grid, Reckitt Benckiser, AstraZeneca, Morrisons, Telecom Plus. So you could have very logically gone for safety, gone for relative stability of demand. And over the last year, you'd have actually underperformed horribly. And I know that your listeners can't take relative performance to pay their bills, but nevertheless, you'd have actually found some of the worst performing stocks over the last 12 months, and you'd have been thinking, oh, goodness. Whereas if you look at what's done best, now there's a smattering of bid players in here. But again, that comes back to your point. That's when the value appears, when things look at their blackest. Yeah. And surprise, surprise, shrewdies, private equity companies, industry peers and rivals have come in and scooped up some of these bids, some of these companies. So William Hill is one, for example. G4S is another one. Kaz Minerals, his name is in there. And then if you're looking at the other companies that have done well, there are some logical pandemic winners. AO World, online delivery of white goods. Premier Foods, you know, everybody sitting on at home in their pyjamas eating ambrosia custard and going for a little bit of comfort. Royal Mail's done itself into a bit of a sort of e-commerce play. And then the gambling stocks have done incredibly well. Hills has been bid for, but that was coming round. Then 888 Group, for example, Playtech. And then also some of the financial market plays, like CMC, for example, where again, you've had people at home who maybe been getting a bit more involved in the markets than they would have done otherwise. And then after that, you've then got some economic recovery plays peeking through. Ferrexpo, Antofagasta, Anglo-American. So again, if you were really brave a year ago and thought, well, this will pass, it's not very nice, but that actually was the way to play. So again, it comes back to the old theme, as you said, right at the top, be greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy. And again, it would have worked out incredibly well if you played safe. All right, you'd have come through the other side, but you'd have actually, you know, done a lot better if performance-wise, if you'd just gone for some of those cyclical recovery plays that we're going to see better times when things did slowly start to get better, as obviously we hope that they are.
Yeah, you know, I set price alerts on mainly small cap, micro cap stocks, but I've got the odd big one up there with good dividends, and I had a price alert come up the other day on GSK, you know, and it was like on a call on an RSI of 30, which is oversold, and it's literally down at 2011. Type levels.
Yeah,
and I thought, what's going on there? And you'd think now, you know, if you just, if you really keep it simple and think, you know, historically, this is an all time low. Is it going to recover? Probably. It's a big company. They've got the money to pull people in if they need to and turn it around. So I just think sometimes you just have to go with the price, you know? And
Emma Walmsley is continuing to sort of restructure the company. I did read in the paper today that they're having good success with their early trials of their new COVID drug, which might get people looking a little bit. I guess one of the reasons why it's lagged is that their initial drug developed with Sanofi just didn't pan out. And so they've gone a bit back to the drawing board. And they're now talking about having a vaccine ready maybe by the end of this year. So which for the world's biggest vaccine company, you feel that they've slightly missed a trick there.
Yeah.
But, it's still a cash generative company. Emma Walmsley looking to shake it up. If they can get some, you know, some COVID treatments going, that may just give people a reason to have a second look at it. Because, yeah, uncannily, it's been dreadful. I guess one thing that might work against it is if we do get an economic recovery, then, you know, pharma stocks might necessarily be where people want to be. But it's going to be, I find it pretty hard to believe that Glaxo is not going to be around for many, many years to come. So,
yeah, on January the 20th, right? This is 2020. It was at 18. It closed at £18.38, and then a dash for cash, it went down to £14, and now it's down at £12.50. So it's grinded. It bounced back up on that dash for cash, like everything else did. Then just grinded lower then for months and months until it's down now. at these levels. So they, there we are. But
it's not doing any good over the last year. Now intriguingly, just that list I've given you there, the lists of best performers and worst performers are very different after Pfizer Monday, the 9th of November, when the world has obviously switched gear from really worrying about the downside to thinking vaccines plus fiscal stimulus plus monetary stimulus means there's got to be a recovery. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, again, if you look at the stocks that have done best since then, I mean, I think you are really going to have been brave to pick up some of these. But Cineworld is the best performer.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think they're allowing anybody in yet, are they?
No.
Still?
No. So, isn't it May? I think May the 17th or 18th. If the data's okay.
I think the US box office is open the weekend that's just gone, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They've just started.
Yeah. So. But yeah, the lovely, well, I always thought it was an independent cinema down the road here from me in Brighton, the Duke of York, but it's owned by Cineworld. So it shouldn't go, which I know, but that's still up. But then other big winners, TUI, First Group, well, there aren't many commuters knocking around yet, but intrigued, but you know, again, a lot of their revenue is, I suppose, underwritten. International Consolidated Airlines, crumbs. Yeah. You think, you know, CNC, the cider company, Hammerson, the commercial property landlord, Capita, which is staff canteens, National Express, SSP Group, which is, you know, Cafe Ritazza and all those things at railway stations. So again, it's really the most, those firms that suffered the most during the pandemic and are therefore, if things go well, show by far the most rapid recovery. Because in some cases, some of those companies may almost have been priced for failure because they were burning cash and that, you know, that they were having to sort of scramble their way. EasyJet's in there as well, scramble their way through to the other side. So you really would have had to have been probably braver than I would have liked to have been on the 6th of November. But again, it just goes to show, you know, the cave that you fear to enter is always the one that holds the treasure that you seek. And if you'd played it safe, what have been the worst 20 performers? Well, AstraZeneca's been down there, JustEatTakeaway.com, Tesco, Experian, boatload of precious metal miners, which I know we touched upon last week, and then things that were perceived to be sort of expensive companies, but reassuringly so, because they had relatively stable profits and cash flows, give you a bit of a guarantee. London Stock Exchange, Reckitt Benckiser, Games Workshop, Rightmove, Spirent, Hikma, Rentokil, Unilever. So again, I think the key there is don't equate reliability with safety on the grounds that if you pay the wrong price, you can still overpay and actually make a safe stock a dangerous stock. Does that make sense?
Looking at
London Stock Exchange last week, it got mown down. The numbers were perfectly solid, but for a stock that's on 30, 40 times earnings, it's like, we're paying how much for that? And I think people just did a second double take and thought, actually, we've possibly overdone it a little bit. And the same for Reckitt and the same for Unilever, I think. So, again, don't mistake reliability for safety. The safety comes from the price that you pay as well as the business model, the two go, and the balance sheet for a 3D view, not a 1D view.
Yeah. Do you know what? I've done a couple of sort of lessons I've learned from investing and videos, and one of them is the price you pay. And I said, of course, price is not value, but I said, there are 3 points to this. I said, you can buy a rubbish company at a good price and make a good bit of money. You can buy a good company at a bad price and sit in a loss for ages. Now, the combination you want to do is buy a good company at a good price, but it's not easy because they're always priced in, you know?
Or a good company at a fair price is what Buffett says. It doesn't have to be absolutely screaming knockdown, but a good company at a fair price will stack the odds in your favour. Because, you know, again, when I was in my investment banking days, basically talking to the hedges who do occasionally dabble and go short stocks as well as go long, and some that was basically their meal ticket. You know, they said that they were always wary of shorting a good company with strong barriers to entry, pricing power, a decent balance sheet, and good money, because they say time's working against you. Yes, the valuation, you know, may cap the upside, but in the end, class will out.
Yeah.
And they say, well, yes, you can buy a quote bad company with a weak competitive position, a stretched balance sheet, management that might not be the straightest, or perhaps don't have pricing power and involved in a dogfight commodity business. So that you can trade those stocks for sure, you can rent them, but owning them is very dangerous because time is working against you, particularly if you know you've got a business that's structurally challenged or is being, you know, hollowed out by some new development. So again, there is a matter of time horizon. But, you know, I mean, Reach has been one of the biggest surprises of this year. You know, it used to be Mirror Group newspapers. Who'd have thought that stock would have more than doubled in the last 12 or 18 months?
Yeah.
But it has, because it is beginning to monetize its online assets.
Yeah.
But it goes to show that I think time is very, if you're a long-term investor, then yeah, good companies at fair prices are the way to go. If you're a trader, fine, punt around with the spinners, the tricky one, but be aware that time may just be nibbling away at you. So they are probably, you know, trades, not owns, as it were. There's a big difference between the two.
Exactly. It's hard to guess. I always say to people who are new, start trading. I said, I wouldn't start trading because the odds are stacked against you. You can't guess where the price is going to be today or tomorrow. You know,
correct.
But you've got a good chance, if it's a good company, that it'll be a lot higher a couple of years' time. So the trend is your friend.
Correct.
Do you know what? It's very odd just looking at the Cineworld chart there. It hit the low in October. Yeah, it hit the low in October 2020 there. It went under to sort of, I think 20 pence there, I'm looking at. Yeah, closed. Close to 25 pence.
And then it
went along the bottom for a while. And then we had Pfizer Day, of course, when the vaccine was announced. Mm-hmm. It was 9th November. And it shot up to 31 pence. But if you look at that, the economy has still been shut then, but it started rising from there. So if we look at when, over here, the economy is going to open in May, that's like 7 months. So how far does stock market look ahead? And you could probably say 6-7 months to that, because they started rising after that date, even though there was no sign that we were going to open up the economy, I suppose, you know? So
I think that's probably right, yeah. Mm,
yeah,
you know, well, so I'd be intrigued. While we're talking, I'll have a quick look at a website that I used to have a look at short interest, just to see if the Cineworld...
That's another thing that someone I saw on Twitter. Someone says, "I heard people whinging about shorting, but I've never ever seen a good business go bankrupt because of shorting. Because good businesses
correct.
Won't, you know."
I think that's absolutely right. And you know, all of your listeners will be thrilled to know that I do not run a public. I mean, Cineworld short interest.
Yeah.
In last November was 10%, and it's now about 6%. So it's come down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if I was a CEO of a company, and all of this would be thrilled to know that I'm not, if somebody went short my stock, I would go and talk to them.
Yeah.
Because the chances are they're doing it just because they think your shares are overvalued, and that's their call, right? There's nothing, you know. As a CEO, your strategy will influence your earnings, and the culture and ethos and tone that you set and the way you communicate will help determine the price that people pay for those earnings. So, and the cycle will do more for your earnings probably than most things, but you can certainly help shape the P by, you know, communicating openly, straight accounting and so on. Mm. So if somebody comes to me and says, I'm short your stock, I'd like to know why.
Yeah.
The chances are it's just a valuation. But they may have seen something in the business model that you haven't. I mean, you never know. They'll have done their homework. But yeah, and actually, funny enough, I did a different podcast yesterday
there's a different podcast, you say? There's a different podcast,
sorry about
is
that.
There?
Only one. Oh, okay. And I found a quote, because I've been reading, because of all the talk of bubbles, I've been rereading all the books, and Edward Chancellor wrote a book. I've only got a version that's about 20 years old called Devil Take the Hindmost. And one of the quotes I found in it at the very end, and please don't take offence on this, everybody, but although short sellers are invariably blamed for the collapse of stock markets, the problem is really caused, in Mr. Chancellor's opinion, by long-only buyers during the preceding bull markets who push stocks to unsustainable levels. Mm. No government has yet seen fit to ban stock purchases during a stock market bubble.
Yeah.
Whereas they will, obviously, as soon as something starts going wrong, the short sellers all get the blame and threatened with more regulation. So I think that is interesting. It comes back to the point again. It's the valuation that you pay, the price that you pay, that determines your return. And again, by all means, pile in, go with the flow, or but beware, if you're giving in to fear of missing out, you're potentially increasing your risks very, very substantially.
Yeah. And if you're a short seller, if they are good, then... And you've got to be good, because it's a lot harder. Like I said, the downside is only 100% maximum, whereas
correct.
The upside is so...
It's infinite. Your downside is infinite, yes.
Yeah, marvellous stuff, Russ. Thanks for that.
Keep well.
We'll speak next week.
I look forward to it.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at 5, Eurasia Mining, down 1.72% to 28.5. At 4, Alba Mineral Resources, up 4.35. Of course, George on the podcast, to 0.36. At 3, Ark Minerals, up 5.76. Did I say Alba's up or down? It's up 4.35%. ARC up 5.76 to 7.35. At 2, Sabian Technology, 3.64% down, 0.133 pence. And at 1, Premier African Minerals, up 22%, 0.305. All right, top 5 most read RNSs are as follows. Sorry, I didn't have the right page. Let's go with six. It's Predator Oil and Gas placing to raise $1.785 million. At five, Kistos proposed acquisition of Tulip Oil, Netherlands. At four, EcTech migration update. At three, it's Albemarle Resources, Clark Ashton Davids. At two, Premier grant of exclusive prospecting or lithium in Premier. One is just an oversight holdings in company. Let's have a look who that is. I don't know if anyone's buying or selling there. BlackRock. It's based on 2.99% now. I don't know if that's up or down for us. But that's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.